geez, would you like me to solve quantum gravity too while I'm at it? This is a real blue sky kind of thing, unfortunately, and I might lose a few people along the way, unfortunately. The two major 20th century concepts are quantum mechanics and general relativity. The problem, though, is that they are not combinable for one particular nasty reason, which is going to seem very obscure to everyone. And that is a concept known as locality. Locality is something we take for granted, and we say that I can't act upon you while I'm sitting here. I have to drive over to your house with a hammer and bang you over the head to act upon your head because I have to be local to you. I can't strike you with a hammer from my house here in Brooklyn. So that's locality. In quantum mechanics, you have non-locality. You have entangled particles that from a distance act on each other that are not local. So quantum mechanics, non-locality. Relativity has locality. Wormholes have an input and an output. All kind of aspects of relativity have a local interaction. They don't act at a distance. So this is a means to kind of squeeze the two together to say that a wormhole is just an entangled particle. I don't quite understand why they think that that's a truism or provable. What really is going on is people are using quantum computers. Quantum computers use entangled particles. So they're using the entangled particles of a quantum computer to adjust their parameters to be similar to a theoretical wormhole, because wormholes only are theoretical. No one has proven they exist. No one has demonstrated one. And another annoying thing about wormholes is the way to open the hole in the wormhole is to inject something called negative energy. What is negative energy? I don't know. You don't know. I don't think the physicists know. But they are able to program a virtual negative energy to do this. So they've designed a model based upon their understanding to prove their model, which seems to be somewhat circular at this time.
Okay, the transition from wormhole to wormhole and the multiverses. Could you say a few words about that?
Again, none of this is proven. This is all highly, highly theoretical. Wormholes only exist in computer programs and mathematical notation. So, again, no proof they exist. It's sort of the same thing as a matter that's made out of imaginary matter is those particles that only travel faster than the speed of light, theoretical particles. Again, there's no proof that they exist. So, the same way, multiverses, there's no way that a multiverse, there's no proof that a multiverse exists. There are theories, there are all kinds of different types of multiverses, but there's no proof for any of them. There's no indication that a black hole, there's theories that a black hole feeds through a wormhole into something called a white hole, where everything is reversed and everything's spewing out of that thing. That is also a mathematical construct, a model without any proven reality. We have never demonstrated the so-called white hole anywhere. So a lot of this is very interesting mathematical conjecture. It is not provable yet. Maybe someday? Probably not.
Okay. So a few words about E equals MPR. Hold on. Okay, the unifying general relativity of quantum mechanics into the theory of everything that was there is a need to make quantum mechanics and general relativity less confusing. That's why if ER equals EPR works, then we actually solve plenty of problems. Let's see.
as the old saying goes, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a wagon. Yeah, if you could solve that, that would be really peachy keen. The big problem, ultimately, is the field that's called quantum gravity. Quantum gravity we have no clue. Again, because quantum gravity requires somehow the merging of quantum mechanics and general relativity. And because one has locality and one has non-locality, you can't do that. So you have to somehow combine the two along with the nature of locality, which gives even physicists headaches, I've told. The bottom line is quantum gravity, yes, it's very important. Anyone who kind of figures anything about quantum gravity will get a Nobel Prize. So feel free to kind of, draw into your notebook. The funny thing is Hawking's radiation, the actual explanation for Hawking's radiation, as described in his very erudite paper on the subject, but not mentioned in his popular book because he didn't trust us to understand what he was talking about, uses a very, very, very special case situation of quantum gravity itself. So quantum gravity has been used for discovery of things, but because it's such a special case, you cannot expand and extend that little solution to anything else. So if you can solve quantum gravity, just stand in line for your Nobel Prize.
So that was, 2013, that was conducted problem, and that was the resolution. And it was the resolution to the AMPS firewall, which is the black hole firewall that is phenomenal, yes. Hypothetical, but anyhow, to the paradox, right? However, the firewall lies into the event cuff horizon than the external superluminal signaling, and that would be possible. I'm reading right now from the article. You could say a few words about event horizon from astrophysics standpoint and the superluminal signalical communication interaction.
Earth to Wesley. Earth Wesley, please acknowledge.
Yes, I can hear you. Dr. Roy?
Okay. You know, Wesley, you can't just kind of read random words within a paragraph and expect me to reconstruct it and figure out what the heck it means. I don't know of anything that's superluminal. Again, this is the problem with locality versus non-locality. Entangled particles can teleport states faster than the speed of light because they're non-local phenomena, although information carried by those particles, by those states, cannot travel faster than the speed of light. So, what can I tell you? Event horizons are simply the point in a black hole geometry where the escape velocity is greater than the speed of light itself. You know, every object in space, every gravitational object has an escape velocity at its surface. Its black hole has an escape velocity of greater than the speed of light. That's the event horizon of the black hole. Nothing escapes it, everything goes in. Until Hawking came up with Hawking radiation, which sort of treats the black hole as a black body radiator. Very big black holes are very, 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 very cold. Their black body radiation is on the order of a fraction of a Kelvin degree. So although everything gets stuck in the black hole, eventually, given enough time, it dissipates out. Smaller, lighter black holes dissipate quicker than bigger, heavier black holes. And black holes have only a few different types of differentiating qualities. It's mass, rotational spin, and charge. It's about the three things that defines just about every black hole in the universe.
Yeah. I think we went too far away into the theory, and I was trying to make a shortcut, and yes, you might. So coming back to fusion, when we have a confinement, a successful configuration must meet few criteria. There would be plasma must be in a time-independent equilibrium state. The equilibrium must be microscopically stable, and the leakage of plasma energy to the bonding cores must be small. And that is with that small capsule that is heated by the lasers. And that one has 10 milligrams of deuterium, which is H2, and tritium H3, right. So that's what actually made the miracles. 250 watts out of every 100 watts. That's what they claim they have. And that includes all of the additional energy spent on cooling of the walls of the chamber. Back to you.
Yeah, Wesley, you got to be cautious when you're reading something where the place where the number is very important. You read H2. Most people would tend to think of that in terms of either H and 2 on the same line. Others would think of it as 2 below, halfway below the H, and that would be elemental hydrogen. That's most of the hydrogen that people experience. You, on the other hand, are reading it as H with subscript 2, which means it's deuterium, and it has a neutron in addition to its proton, and that 2 is its atomic weight.
Thank you for correcting my English, Dr. Roy. Back to you.
No, that's just it. It's kind of important. Usually, most people will say H2 is deuterium and H3 is tritium. So it makes it a lot less confusing. Otherwise, you don't quite know if you're talking about molecules or isotopes or what.
Okay, so what's the reality? You are pessimistic, I'm optimistic. What is the truth? 10 years, 12 years, let's say somebody like Elon Musk decides to invest into it. Actually, there are plenty of companies actually worked many years on it.
And they will continue to invest, and governments will invest money too. It's a legitimate a branch of research with a great deal of benefits once it's been totally solved, but you cannot predict how long it takes to solve something at the beginning of, unless you've traveled that journey before, and we haven't, you don't know how far it is. When Columbus set out, he thought the Earth was much, much smaller. He thought that there was no continent in the way, and he thought he was going to land in India.
Dr. Roy, I have a question for you. Maybe somebody else wants to respond, and then we're going to have a time for the space report. The reason we don't have a treatment for cancer is because when university gets the grant, they want to get another grant. They want to, it's a money to feed them. Okay, so if they actually make a breakthrough, there's no more money. The money goes to a manufacturing facility. So the same story is, okay, we have a government agency or government sponsor agency, and we have a number of labs. They're going to get the grant, and then they're going to be doing any kind of research for many years. That could be done in a few days, maybe. True or false? Back to you.
Well, incredibly false. It is misleading and somewhat paranoid to kind of really believe that research scientists who also die of cancer, I hate to tell you, would basically screw up the cure for cancer and die early because their boss needs a new Lamborghini or something. That isn't how the universe runs. Cancer is very difficult to cure because cancer is not one disorder. Cancer is a wastebasket of hundreds of different problems. It is a malregulation on a cellular level of a whole bunch of different cell lines in a whole bunch of different ways, manifesting a whole bunch of separate problems to be solved. There have been advances in some aspects of cancer. Leukemias have much higher survival rates than they did in the past, and hopefully things will get better in general. But to kind of simply dismiss the lack of a universal cure for cancer as being those greedy farmer guys or whatever, I think is the way of madness. You know, it's all these people who are anti-vaxxers and flat earthers and all kinds of strange things.
Okay, and how that relates to fusion? So when we have less of the unknown, or maybe different kind of unknown, basically.
As much as I'm not a fan of the Koch brothers, although one of the Koch brothers has met his maker, I do not think that he is actively endeavoring to scuttle fusion reactors. I don't think he's worried about fusion reactors. By the time that fusion reactors might be online, he will long since have decomposed upon this earth. So, I don't think anyone is actively disrupting fusion research. Now, that doesn't mean that I believe that people who make a lot of money in fossil fuel industries aren't particularly the ones investing in fusion technology. I think those are the big industrial companies that figure that they're going to make billions, if not trillions, on manufacturing these fusion generators and such. But still, I tend to believe that most problems on this world are not due to organized evil people, but large groups of very disorganized, incompetent fools.
Dr. Rory, let me be a devil's advocate for a moment. We say that oil is less complicated, but it's a source of energy, right? It has to be digged for, excavated, whatever. And you say that you don't believe that this and that and this and that. Well, look, we had a war in Iraq based on false statements. And we know that Mr. Bush is an oil guy. So if that was one of the reasons we might think for the war, right? Because somebody wants to make money on it. They compare it with clean energy, if it's possible. Back to you.
Well, like I said before, like I'll probably say again, fossil fuels are the mainstay of energy for the industrial world. There's a lot of money to be made, all kinds of different ways. So, all things being equal, there's going to be a lot of people who try and get to their hands on as much oil reserves as they can. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're scuttling fusion research, which is being, I'm sure they're spending billions of dollars on fusion research. It's not like if you add up all the money being spent on research for fusion energy, you're not going to come up with $2,345,000.83. You know, there's a lot of money being thrown at this. And some would kind of say that, you know, it's not a short-term beneficial thing because, you know, they've been throwing the same money since the 50s. But again, I don't believe in the sinister cabal beliefs of people. Again, the basis for my worldview, again, is less that there are a few brilliant geniuses manipulating us, because Elon Musk is certainly not a genius, but there are lucky, stupid people doing silly things all over the place.
Okay. Before I agree with you or disagree with you, in 2020, Netta Crawford, chair of political science department of Boston University, estimated the cost of war in Iraq, $1.922, so it's almost $2 trillion. Imagine that this money is pumped into the cold fusion. Not the cold fusion, I'm sorry. Into the fusion. Back to you.
That was a hell of a Freudian slip, Les. Sometimes you could just solve something by throwing money at it. A lot of times, unfortunately, you can't. And I think that's the case in fusion technology. It's not like you could train everyone who used to work at Burger King to be a high-energy physicist. So you're kind of limited. It sort of goes back to a strange thing that has nothing to do with technology or the technet. My belief of why a lot of movies and television and books are crap is because they're pumping out way too much material. Presently, the streaming services and networks are pumping out some ridiculous thing like 6,000 television shows a year. And, you know, at that rate, you can't find enough competent writers to write a phone book. So I think it's the same situation, that there becomes a point of diminishing return for throwing money because there's only so many limited, brilliant people out there, and you need brilliant people to solve these problems.
Interesting. Mr. Ray, you're actually right for today, but we don't know what's going to be in tomorrow. We know that almost $2 trillion were spent because some oil guy wanted to make a war, and American soldiers' life was lost. And we know that we have a technology that might not be successful, like a war in Afghanistan at $1 trillion cost after 20 years. But we do it. So is it worth? Is it worth, instead of fighting, spending $1 trillion in American soil, so Americans can make the money on it, so America can grow up, so America can benefit on it? Prove me wrong. And to agree.
No, I agree with you. The whole point of alternative energy is that if we become one of the main investors and developers and manufacturers, it's a whole new industry that we can make a lot of money and people can become rich. It's not the same people who got rich on fossil fuels, which is part of the problem, because those guys are paying politicians a lot of money in their campaign funds to keep things the status quo. Most people in power prefer to stay in power. The status quo is kind of designed to do just that, and it will slow down the next era, but it won't stop it. Nothing stops progress. It only slows it down to its nail space.
I do thank you very much, Dr. Roy, and everybody who is listening to us. All I want to say at the end of the discussion is my office, where I was the president of my scientific entity, working with NASA, Department of Defense, and plenty of others, DARPA, and plenty of others, also gold mining industry and copper mining industry, was at 77th floor of World Trade Center 1. I don't want to say more, because it's going to be too controversial. Dr. Roy.
Yes, okay, very good, Wesley. I wouldn't quite bring up that subject this time of the year type of thing, because I don't know if you're familiar with an interesting new congressman called John Santos, who and I'm not saying that you had an office at the World Trade Center, but One of the many things that he fibbed about was that his mother almost died in her office in the World Trade Center. In some stories, she was the top financial executive. In others, she was a housekeeper. And she died 15 years later after that happened. So just out of the news, I wouldn't kind of bring that up there because it kind of has slight weird echoes for news stories of the week.
Yeah, Dr. Roy, the reasoning is different. This gentleman, I don't want to use the strong words, was Republican, representing some Americans and locally elected, this guy has a problem. I can say to everybody, I'm nobody. I am completely nobody. I'm only somebody if I grow up to the point at which somebody sees the value in me. This guy doesn't want that. He wants to have a value. It's falsificated value. It's not existing value. He built that value, but he wants that value. And he doesn't want to resign. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I don't want to go into too much politics tonight. That's not a good place for the repeater. I hope everything gets settled. My guess is that eventually there'll be some financial shenanigans. There's some kind of $700,000 that came into being by magic and went into his campaign, listed as money he made. I don't think he made more than $50,000 a year, so that's going to be interesting. So I think it's going to be somewhat self-correcting, but we'll leave that for the news stations and such and move on to the space report. Okay, Wesley?
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And time for our space report guy.
Yes, indeed. It is time for the SpaceNet report. So please, Paul, of US2S, give us the SpaceNet.
Okay. ACTGS, WS2N. And okay, on all. Good net so far. And hope to continue. This is WS2N Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. A lot of little stories going by here for the last couple of weeks. We had some time last week. So during the last 2 weeks anyway, one thing that came up was the Soyuz leak. Soyuz, our crew spacecraft that's attached to the International Space Station, actually attached to the RASPID module, one of the docking modules on the Russian side. On the Russian side, they have four different locations to dock, and on the American side, we also have four sites for docking ports. Well, the one that he's attached, this one is attached to, that brought up two Russians and one American. Will be always the American. Got a coolant leak, and now they're trying to figure out where this coolant leak came from. Originally, they were thinking, well, maybe it came from a meteor strike from the Gemini meteor shower, but they realized that where the leak is coming from, they checked it out with the Canada robotic arm, and they could see that it's on a side where it wouldn't be hit with the media. It would have to be on the other side. So now they've got to decide themselves on where this actually came from. Trying to decide what to do. Bring up maybe another unmanned craft docket with the space station. They could go home on that. These things are all autonomous. They could dock by themselves. They could bring up a spacecraft that's empty. Send it back full. That's one possibility. And then other possibilities, we have another different type of crew vehicle going up called Starliner, being built by Boeing. Last May it went up docked with the space station again, all autonomous. The first time it actually made it to the space station. It's designed to carry a crew of four, and you can do the same thing with another one. Actually, there's a scheduled launch of two astronauts that are going to be flying up this coming April. And of course, that schedule could all change. The other possibility is to try to fix this leak in place. They don't think it's probable. All the ammonia that was in the system has already leaked out. So they would actually have to fix the leak and then bring up ammonia to charge it into the system. And that's very problematic. They don't like to bring ammonia tanks inside the space station. Ammonia always stays on the outside. So we'll see. As time goes on, we'll find out what's going to happen with this particular vehicle and how they're going to get that crew home. Any comments? WS2S. Okay, spacewalk, a couple of spacewalks that were actually canceled during the last couple of weeks. One with the Russians. They had a problem with the spacesuit. And the Americans, they canceled the spacewalk, and eventually they wound up doing it, but temporarily canceled it due to space junk that was flying by. The space junk is originated from a year or so ago when the Russians blew up one of their own satellites, which created debris, and that debris stretched out, you know, many, many miles, or, you know, like a long, narrow path, but that narrow path crosses the International Space Station every now and then. So that was happening at one particular point. They were going to go out, but they canceled it, and eventually they did go out. Which is, it's a scheduled EVA for the NASA. So they could delay it, which they did, and that was to install another set of ROSA is Rollout Solar Array System for the space station. They're supplementing the amount of electricity that they can get on the International Space Station. Right now it's around 160 kilowatts of power, and they want to bring that up to around 215. Last year they already put another set of solar arrays up, and this will be another one, and then in the near future, probably maybe the end of this year or beginning of next year, they'll bring up another set to complete the job. It takes a couple of EVAs to do each set. Anyway, any comments? WS2S. Okay. NASA is continuing work on a spacecraft that will eventually be going to Titan. Right now they're working extensively on the blades, the helicopter blades. It's called the Dragon, Dragonfly mission that's going to be going to that moon, going around Saturn. Dragonfly, instead of sending a rover like we've done many times with Mars, and landing and having a rover drive around on a planet, and NASA plans on sending Dragonfly to the moon of Titan. It will actually come down, and it's got these big blades on it. You know, after it re-enters the atmosphere, these blades are going to turn on. It's going to be 8 helicopter blades, and I think we'll be able to fly from location to location, all electric, of course. The atmosphere is extremely dense on that moon, so spinning these blades and flying will be relatively easier, a lot easier than it would here on Earth. We have 8 different blades you know, sets of two, and with each blade, one will spin in the opposite direction. They haven't figured that it, eventually one of these blades fail. It doesn't matter. They'll be able to compensate for it. So it should be interesting. They'll be able to land. They'll have a robotic arm. They'll be able to do tests, camera, and then eventually take off, fly to another location. And theoretically, this could go on for years because the power source is an RTG. RTG is a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. Same type of thing that they have on the two American rovers that are driving around on Mars. Curiosity and Perseverance both have RTGs. So, you know, I'm the rover will be sitting on the surface. It's got these big skids instead of wheels, you know, and during that shutdown, when the vehicle is on the ground, it could be charging with this 110-watt RTG system. You know, runs on plutonium-239. It takes the heat from that, and the heat from that source heats up these thermocouples through series and parallel thermocouples. Eventually, they generate this 28-volt 109-watt system to recharge batteries. When they charge, take off and fly to another location and do more research on that moon. Now, since they've had such great luck with a helicopter on Mars, last rover that went up, Perseverance, on the belly, they had a helicopter that they released. Been flying around on Mars ever since. That was what, back in August of last year? No, correction, that was in February of last year. So, very successful. They hope to get 5 flights out of Ingenuity, that's the name of the helicopter. They're now up to 37 flights. So every time the rover moves, the thing takes off and flies somewhere else. So it's so successful that they're going to design not only a helicopter for the moon Titan that's going around Saturn, but they're going to send eventually 2 more helicopters to Mars in the future. Titan is it's not totally unexplored. Back in 1997, NASA launched the Cassini spacecraft to Saturn to orbit it, which eventually went into orbit in 2004. As it went into orbit, it also released a lander, Huygens lander, went through the atmosphere of Titan and actually landed on Titan and transmitted video, pictures and examined the rocks nearby, and it lasted about an hour. They said an hour and 10 minutes on the surface before the batteries quit. Well, this time around with Dragonfly with the RTG on board, the batteries they're really never going to quit. They'll constantly be recharged. So we'll see. That's not due to go to Titan and launch. I think launch date is 2027. Then allow around 6 to 7 years to get to Titan. We'll see. It's a cloud-covered moon. Yeah, scientists would love to get a lot more information about that place. They know that it has lakes on the moon. Not water lakes, but lakes made of ethane, so they'll investigate that with Dragonfly. Any comments? WS2N. Again, name is Paul. Wonder if anybody got involved with this. If anybody gets the ARRO messages, you know, the emails a couple of weeks ago. They sent the information about the HOP system in Alaska that was going to get involved with transmitting signals to bounce off an asteroid that was, you know, flying not close to Earth, but close enough, about two times the distance away from the moon. They're going to use HOP, which is an acronym for a High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program that was built in the 90s in Alaska. It's north, a little northeast of Fairbanks, Alaska. It's naturally out in the middle of nowhere, but they have the capability of transmitting a tremendous amount of power. They have acres of antennas set up, and they can transmit straight up in the air. You know, it was designed by Dopper and completely built out. But now it's being controlled by, they turned it over to a college up in Alaska who actually run this facility. And they got the idea to transmit a signal, bounce it off the asteroid that's going to be flying by. This happened 27th, a couple of days after Christmas. And they transmitted for, I think, 10 to 12 hours or something. Chirping, you would hear chirping noises if you were listening to it. They transmitted on 9.6 megahertz. You know, near the 40-meter band. Anyway, they asked for hams to receive it. I didn't do it. I was involved with something else. I hope they do this again, but because I didn't get a chance to do it. But I do know. Lou was on the other day. He did it. I heard a recording, and sure enough, it was chirp, chirp, chirp. And if you take these chirp noises and decode it to an MP3. I guess you get data out of it, send it into, they give the address, and eventually we get a QSL card from them. I hope they do it again, but they need another asteroid to fly by to do it. I don't think anyone, a big asteroid like that is going to come fly anytime soon. Made a test, they transmitted, I believe they bounced signals off the moon. See how that worked first, and you know, everything was working. That sounded interesting. Anyway, if anybody needs information about HOP, Weimark had a fellow that was heavily involved with that project do a presentation. So if you look on the Weimark website, you go to YouTube, go to all their YouTube videos. You'll find one for HOP, I think it was an hour and 15 minutes or so. Presentation, very well done by this guy. He knew all about HOP. Anyway, any comments? WS2N. Okay, there was a South Korean spacecraft that went into orbit around the moon. It's called Danori. Danori is the... was launched by a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. Back in August, took a long way around to do it, but eventually it got into orbit around the moon. It went out almost a million miles past the moon, and eventually the gravity of the moon pulled it back. And it had thrusters on board and was able to a highly elliptical orbit. Around 60 miles above the surface, and then apogee is, I think they said around 8,000 kilometers, so I don't know, probably about 5,000 or 6,000 miles above the surface. I don't know if they're going to circularize it. I would imagine eventually they will. Right now it's highly elliptical, but it's South Korea's first orbital mission of the moon. They're really pouring with billions of dollars into their space program. I have They've actually launched rockets from that country, and they're planning on a very large rocket in the future, which eventually they could launch their own equipment to the moon if they wanted. Eventually, a manned program. They have a manned program in mind for the 2030s with South Korea. So the moon's going to become a very big, very busy place in the next 10 to 20 years. It should be occupied by quite a few people. Hopefully, the United States will lead the way. I think we will. We already had Artemis up there for 25 days. Came back successfully. And I would imagine it's going to continue like that. Roughly 2 years from now, you're going to have Artemis 2, the crew orbiting the moon, again returning to Earth. And then Artemis 3 will be a landing of the moon, probably in a year or so after that. Looks like 2025 at the earliest date. Anyway, anybody have any comments? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report. Okay, I mentioned the Perseverance rover, one that brought up Ingenuity, landed there a year ago. Very successful robotic mission on Earth. They look way over 2,000 pounds. Gravity is around one third on the planet Mars, but it's been driving around, doing science, drilling into rocks, you know, core boring the rocks. Not just all the previous rovers would drill into rocks and we'd get powdered dust and granules, and the robotic arm would put it into a device, and they would be able to figure out what it was made of, box of soil we're talking about, no problem. But they would like to get more detailed information. To do that, you need to have these samples returned to Earth. So on this mission, they have a core boring machine, and they core bore samples. They have around 40 test tube light things. Eventually take these samples, and the idea is to bring them back to Earth. To do that, they have to leave them somewhere. So they temporarily, right now, it's like 15 of these things stored inside the belly of the rover. But at a certain point, they're going to release one at a time to land on the surface. Now, they've already done that. They've located, big flat areas, maybe 20 feet in diameter, where there's no rocks or anything in the way. And they would put these samples in, one at a time, different 10-foot locations, not on top of one another. And the idea is eventually have a fetch rover go back in the future and pick these samples up, bring them back to the land that the fetch rover came from, put these samples into a solid fueled rocket, and eventually the solid fueled rocket would launch from Mars, dock with an orbiter around Mars, and that orbiter would have enough fuel to send it out of orbit around from Mars back to Earth. But, this one step has now started to be complete. They've actually put a couple of these test tubes, core samples, onto the planet of Mars. They're just leaving them there. Then they have a camera and a robotic arm that looks underneath the rover, takes a picture, make sure it's located in the proper location.
That's time complete.
And anyway, the sample is left on the surface for the fetch rover eventually to pick it up. So let's say the fetch rover breaks down. Well, one of the things that they're going to be sending up is a couple more helicopters on that flight. A helicopter A and a helicopter B. They would send the helicopter fly to the location where these things are being left, So down land, it's going to have a claw on it. It's going to be able to grab the sample and fly it back to the solid fueled rocket, where it will put the sample into the same container that's eventually going to be flown back to Earth. So they're really moving along. Someday in the future, looks like a couple of years from now, they'll launch an orbiter around Mars that will eventually bring the samples back, and then a separate launch will land fetch rover onto Mars along with two rovers. And there's also a possibility to cut course, not to even send the fetch rover, and just use interference to go out, bring them back, and then have the helicopters as backup. Anyway, that's the latest I've read recently on the plans to bring samples back from the Perseverance rover. There's commercial crew flights that have started last year. Virgin Galactic sent a lot of people up, on their, that was a year or so ago on their vehicle, Unity, as they call it, and they flew half a dozen people to suborbital space a couple of years ago, and they plan on continuing that next year. Blue Origin sent up quite a few flights, including William Shatner, an 83-year-old lady, an 18-year-old young fella. Space tourism is now going to be big news in the future. SpaceX has really started it with the Axiom group. Axiom is paying SpaceX to launch crews to the space station. Recently, during last year, they launched a crew of four to the space station. Now they have two more Axiom missions planned for this year. Axiom's long-term goal is to actually send a new module up to the space station, launch a new module attached to our ISS, where eventually their crews that they're sending up already will eventually be able to sleep and work in the new module. They plan on actually a couple of modules with their own solar panels. This way, when the International Space Station is decommissioned somewhere in the 2030s, these new modules that are going up Axiom could separate from the space station and become their own independent space station, commercial space station. Well, that's the goal of Axiom. We'll see how the tourism goes for 2023. Any comments? If not, we're going to turn it back to Roy. Let him wrap this all up. Tomorrow night will be the Club InfoNet on these frequencies. And that's usually followed by George with the Swap and Shop, and of course, Newswine after that. Always good to listen to that. It always has space topics on Newswine. Roy, AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Very good, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all really appreciate it. I wish you a happy, healthy new year for you and your family. As well, to everyone listening and participating or just sitting back and listening, thanks for coming around tonight. Especially for those who participated. I hope some people learned some things. I hope some people taught other people some things. And I hope more than a few were amused by some things that they heard tonight. And I hope you'll come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do it all over again. As always, I want to remind people, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. My links page is roy.ac2gs.com. and the audio stream is technet.at2gs.com. So keep that in mind, as well as MyKT2NJI's Great Amateur Radio.tv archive site that has lots and lots of the Limewatt technical net. I want to remind people that Dick always would end the technical net, be kind to each other. We're going to get a little bit of a bump in COVID, unfortunately, so please be smart, be protective, take good care of yourself and your loved ones, and heck, even your hated ones. Be well, be healthy, have a happy and healthy new year, and once again, I'll drag out good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas. It won't give you a problem. Thanks again to everyone. Be well. We'll talk again next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we do it all over again. This is AC2GS formally closing this New Year's episode of the Limewatt Technical Net, and I am clear.
KT2VHT, thank you, Roy, and others, for all that you do.
WD2AD.
Yes, sir.
I didn't have anything to pipe up with on the net, so I just listened. But I just checked that thing you sent me. It looks interesting. Your feeling is justified. It might very well be what Andy's looking for to be determined.
Certainly isn't a customized high-speed widget, but I think it might serve. Is that good enough? I don't know, but I figured I'd throw you away.
It seems to be pretty much, what Andy had to look for and wants. Thank you very much for the release.
You are very welcome. I hope it helps. Have a good night. Welcome, KD2VHD.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
morning. The time is 1:55 a.m. Mostly cloudy. Temperature 40.